Okay, fuck. What episode will this be?
33? Is it 33?
Hold on, let me check it real quick. Oh, this will be 32. 32. Okay. Okay. Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 32 of Chapo Trap House. Listeners, you're going to join us in our mass suicide about the movie Suicide Squad in just a few, but just two bits of show-related business that we need to address. Number one, Chapo Trap House is now available on Spotify. Add us to your Discover Weekly playlists. If that's a thing, please do it. Follow us on Spotify. Share us on Spotify. We're on Spotify, is what I'm trying to say.
More importantly than money is we get your demographics, which is what we really want, so that we can target market to you.
We need better analytics, and that's what Spotify is going to do for us.
Just use some of your grandmother's spare AOL free minute discs. I'm sure that she's got tons of them lying around her house.
Go to a public library and create fake accounts on all of the computers and subscribe and listen to our show on all of them.
That is called the Giordano method.
Okay, last bit of business before we commit suicide. You already heard, if you were a Grey Wolf subscriber, the live audio of our show in Philadelphia. There is now, thanks to the Street Fight Boys, there is a concert film of our entire live show in Philadelphia and our week in Philadelphia with behind the scenes extras and a beautifully edited together concert film of Chapo Street Fight Live in Philadelphia. It is available on Vimeo, and if you use the code CHAPOSTICK, you get $3 off. It only costs $2 to download the Chapo plus Street Fight concert film. So please, everyone go do that too, and do it and steal money from your parents and do it to them as well. And then I guess third bit, Matt, Frost Chrisman, debuting soon?
Tuesday. It's all shot and cut, or it was all recorded and cut together. I used GarageBand for the first time, and fair warning, there was a botch on a recording, so it's, I'm not going to sound that good. Hammer's going to sound great, but everybody sounds legible. You can hear everybody, but I promise they'll get better from here on out. I mean, our first show was terrible. Yeah, it's going to sound way better than that one did. We're going to drop that on Tuesday.
Okay, and the two films you're discussing are All the President's Men and Parallax View.
Yes, the excellent. Alan J. Pakula paranoia movies of the 70s.
Okay, well, how about we all discuss Suicide Squad right now with Matt B. Brady?
Yeah, let's do it.
Does that sound good?
All three of some shrimp on the bobby.
Suicide, it's a suicide. So you wanna die, commit suicide, dial 1-800-SINAI line. Far's right, yo, it ain't worth it, put a rope around your neck and jerk it.
Okay, guys, we're here for one reason and one reason only, and that is to discuss Suicide Squad.
Fuck yeah!
Hell yeah!
The film of 2016.
The film of the 21st century you're talking about.
Let me just say, actually, in Australia, the film was called Captain Boomerang and His Mates, The Suicide Squad.
Just sorry, by way of introduction, I am Will Menaker. Joining me as usual, Matt Christman.
Hello. G'day.
Felix Biederman.
I don't give a shit what happens on this podcast. I just want full custody of my daughter when I'm done.
And making his triumphant return to the Trap House, none other than Matt V. Brady.
Oh, it's great to be back on Chapo Trapo Houso, as we call it in Australia.
Like I said, by way of introduction, real fans of the Trap will remember Matt V. Brady from our discussion of the first big summer blockbuster, Batman vs. Superman. And now it's like, that was at the beginning of the summer. That was like way back in, I don't know, April or May or something. It wasn't even the summer. But now we're closing out the summer movie season with the Suicide Squizzad.
I'm sorry, but isn't it more polite to call it the winter movie season? Since
that's right.
In the southern hemisphere, it's winter right now. if I'm not mistaken.
That is correct.
Yeah, Matt Brady's from Australia, everybody. He's recording this right now in the Anthony Cumia Melbourne studio. But, yeah, so Suicide Squad, it's the movie everyone's talking about. It's the movie Felix has already written an article about for Deadspin. It's the summer film that was too dark and twisted to get made.
Yeah, look, I mean, I don't consider myself a hero, but I've gotten heard rumors around the slacks that actually my article is going to keep Gawker from going bankrupt. They made so much money off ad revenue that they can pay down the debt that they owe Peter Thiel, and I just want to say that's, you know, that's just kind of what I do. I don't really think
because
of it.
Because
like,
of that article, every man in America is now a subscriber to the Dollar Shave Club.
Well, there's a lot to discuss in this movie. A
whole lot going on.
Yeah, a whole lot going on in this movie. But before we get into the film itself, I think we have to stay true to our roots, which is political economy and a materialist analysis of politics and culture. And I think we should open this discussion with a little bit about the making of Suicide Squad. And I just want a couple of things for reference that I think will help us understand this film that we all saw. And I want to open with an article that was in the Hollywood Reporter on August 3rd by Kim Masters. The headline is Suicide Squad Secret Drama: Rushed Production, Competing Cuts, High Anxiety. This article, she speaks with a lot of people behind the scenes at Warner Brothers and people in the know about all the shit that went down with like recutting this movie and, you know, how they were, you know, basically desperate to just get it out there and make money off it, but also how Suicide Squad and this ridiculous drama behind the production of it is really indicative of everything that's going on in Hollywood right now, and how like these giant tentpole superhero movies are basically the only thing that make money for movie theaters. I'm sorry, for movie studios, and as a result, basically nothing makes sense at all about the making of these movies.
Yeah, the thing it reminded me of is. And I think this is why Suicide Squad is very instructive on this very point, is that the entire Warner Brothers relationship to their comic book properties, their DC comic book properties, is very much a refighting of the Vietnam War. It's a tale of just sunk costs, mission creep, just this steadily like unraveling, putting faith into local actors who you sure have the ability to really come through, and then them failing you miserably. Like Zack Snyder's sort of like a no diem DM character whose assassination following the failure of Batman versus Superman was supposed to fix things, and that just led to a situation where Suicide Squad, which had originally been a minor little like moneymaker for the end of the summer, sort of a way to put icing on the cake that was supposed to be the multi-billion dollar take from Batman versus Superman, now has this massive amount of pressure on it. Now, according to some sources, has to make almost $1 billion to break even, very much like the massive investment in American troops, blood and treasure that followed the assassination of Diem in Vietnam. And it's going to, I think, frankly, going to probably have the same result. Just this slog, lost money, lost lives, just continued failure, and just no vision at all on how to actually win this damn thing. And Suicide Squad is also a microcosm of that, because it started the same way in that it had a vision for one guy, David Ayer, the director, and then after Batman vs. Superman tanked and everyone realized, oh, we don't want anything this gritty, they panicked and they basically ousted him and had other people edit the movie, very much like the removal of William Westmoreland and his replacement with Creighton Abrams. And
absolutely, absolutely. In this analogy, the assassination of DM was the rather lackluster release of Batman vs. Superman. David Ayer is General Westmoreland, and it said, you know, basically once they, as it says here in the Hollywood Reporter article, it basically says, though the studio believed there was enough time to get the movie done, a source with ties to the project said it was a sprint from the start. As soon as they announced that, you know, release date, the release was pushing back the release was not an option. So it was like basically Operation Rolling Thunder. quoting further from the Hollywood Reporter, it says, "Asorth with knowledge of events, say Warner's executives, nervous from the start, grew more anxious after they were blindsided and deeply rattled by the tepid response to Batman vs. Superman. Kevin," that's speaking of Warner Brothers CEO, Kevin Tujihara, "Kevin was really pissed about the damage to the brand. A key concern for Warner's executives was that Suicide Squad didn't deliver on the fun, edgy tone promised in the strong teaser trailer for the film. So while Ayer pursued his original vision, Warner set about working on a different cut with an assist from Trailer Park, the company that had made the teaser." So essentially, remember, like, they released this the trailer for Suicide Squad with the Queen song in it, and a lot of people seemed to like it, and they thought, holy shit, the movie we have is nothing like this trailer. Why don't we just get the trailer company to recut this entire movie into something fun and cheeky?
It was essentially a series of 3-minute music videos is what they cut it into.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the thing people need to realize is that any trailer that is cut to the rhythm of a song is going to be good. It's just it's true. An effective mechanism for making a trailer. It gives it a sense of rhythm. It gives it a kind of a narrative spine and a crescendo. It can't miss. I mean, I don't know if you guys saw the really shitty David Fincher version of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, which is a 3-hour fucking just slog. Oh,
yeah, same.
But it had this trailer that was cut to a cover of The Immigrant Song, and it fucking ruled. And I was like headbanging my way, you know, I was like, get see this thing. And the movie itself is just dire. Like that's an easy way to sell anything. And now I guess that's all we have, because if it's just going to be like name recognition for properties and trailers, then every movie is, I guess, just going to be this panicked assemblage of recognizable songs like this one was, because this thing is just wall to wall, you know, pop hits from the last 30
or
40 years.
Matt, you alluded to this earlier, but it says the goal here is survival. The movie's got to do $750 million, $800 million to break even. If they get anywhere close to that, they'll consider it a win. So the movie has to make $1 billion to be profitable, basically.
Why wouldn't you expect that from a movie starring a guy with a boomerang? And an alligator guy.
And a juggalette.
But, I mean, this goes to our conversation with Amber about Lady Ghostbusters. It speaks essentially to the same problem. There's so much money involved in these movies that there's basically no way it can be sane or sensible outcome at all. Because they focus group and they test everything, and they ended up with 3 cuts of this movie that they blended together into, like you said, Brady, a collection of music videos.
Well, I mean, in that sense, I consider this less like Vietnam and more like another great war, the Iraq War. And by that I mean, okay, so we have the original Suicide Squad comic book, but it's old, everyone who wrote it is dead, we don't know what they wanted. That makes it the Constitution. We have David Ayer. He is Ahmed Chalabi. He goes to Warner Brothers, who is America, and he goes, we have weapons of mass destruction, and we can have democracy, and that means make a twisted movie. But, like, because of certain factors on the ground that were aggravated, we have this outcome. But it's, you know, in the end, it's good. And it caused the Arab Spring, which, the equivalent of which will happen in a few years when everyone realizes that this movie was good and dresses up like the Joker.
I gotta say, though, you say that, oh, they cut 3 versions of the movie together. You certainly couldn't tell.
No, not at all.
It did not have any kind of feeling of just being a hastily edited collection of obviously montaged scenes and diced up shit. It didn't feel that way. It felt seamless.
Yeah, no, I mean, not at no point during the movie was I like, this doesn't belong here, why am I watching this scene? The movie was the exact length that it should have been. Overall, like, a seamless experience.
You never had a situation where scenes basically repeated themselves and you had characters being introduced twice? Almost in a row. You never had that. That never happened.
So I think that's some of the background to this fiasco and what's going on at Warner Brothers right now, which also includes that about 10% of the people who work there have been laid off over the course of the last year or so. And it's largely because of Zack Snyder and Suicide Squad.
Those are all those monks who set themselves on fire.
So like I said, that's the background to the movie itself. But let's get into the real shit, the real fun, which is the movie itself. In that Hollywood Reporter article, one of the things they talk about is the cut of the movie that focus grouped most positively was the one that had crazy graphics and introduced all the members of the Suicide Squad early on, right away. So I think, you know, I don't want to buck market research. Let's go through. Let's run down the whole squizzod right now.
Deadshot. Guy shoots people. He's a crocodile. And he eats people. Burns people. You're possessed by a witch. And she's just crazy.
What was that? I should kill everyone and escape?
Felix, you did this in your article for Deadspin. And I'm going to sort of follow your lead. But let's break it down. Beginning with Deadshot, played by Will Smith, who is sort of the... he's sort of the closest thing to an audience stand-in. He's sort of the moral center.
Right, he is the moral compass of the entire movie. Deadshot's superpower, his stated superpower, is that he is the most accurate marksman on Earth, that he can hit any shot, that he can kill anyone. His real superpower is fatherhood. The conflict driving Deadshot is that while he is the world's most deadly assassin, he cannot, for the life of him, get sole custody of his daughter from his worthless mother. He is a disgusted dad. Yes, he can practically kill anyone on Earth, but he is somehow hamstrung by a family court. Judge can't just kill her, even though he's presumably killed thousands of people.
Deadshot is introduced hitting a bank shot into the back of some witness's head from the top of an office building. But then almost immediately after that, he's seen like Christmas shopping with his daughter wearing some sort of very sort of custom fedora. He's Christmas shopping with her with his daughter and asking about her mom's boyfriend and whether she stays out late at the club when she should be, you know, raising her child while he's off killing people, presumably. But then they're accosted in an alleyway by none other than Batman, a little cameo by Ben Affleck.
Oh, yeah, Batman's in this film.
And, like, Deadshot is going to, like, you know, fire a bullet that's going to bank off of a stop sign, go through another person's head, and then, like, you know, curve around back into Batman or something like that. But his daughter gets in front of him and is like, no, Dad, don't do it. I can't. And so, essentially, he allows himself to be arrested by Batman because his daughter told him to.
This, by the way, is, for me, all the proof I need that the original David Ayer gritty cut of this movie is not to be mourned. I'm fairly certain it sucks badly as well, because it was when it was time to write this movie, and he was like, okay, so I need one of these guys to sort of be the protagonist, even though he's a bad guy. What can I do to give him audience sympathy and a character arc? I know. He just wants his kids back. Holy shit, David Ayer. Where'd you find that one?
Well, yeah, I mean, like, this is sort of the problem with Suicide Squad, and I could tell that it existed even before it was recut, that David Ayer is a very Dutatian man. And the thesis of this movie actually is, like, the most twisted and badass thing you can do is to follow all the rules.
It's true. That's absolutely
true. But we're going to get to that later.
We'll get to
that, yeah, so, like... Deadshot, disgusted dad, Carl Digler with an ability to kill. Batman sends him to prison. Batman, presumably, like, extra disgusted by this guy who had given up his seed to create a daughter. But, you know, we'll get to that. Anyway, he's in prison. Who do we got next?
He's sent to jail for the crime of just wanting to be in his daughter's life and killing probably a few hundred people for money. Next up, we got Harley Quinn.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, hell yeah. Yeah. Hell yeah. Hell yeah. We all got our hands down our pants right now. We're all jacking off. All the boys are on cam. We're camming with each other, jacking off right now.
Chop up cam, boys.
Yes.
We're going off for Harley Quinn right
now. Hell yeah, baby.
She's probably the most eye-catching thing from the trailer that everybody liked.
But
I don't know. How would you guys describe Harley Quinn's character?
Hey, Harley Quinn is the type of girl you take home to meet your family if you're in the freaking Manson family.
It just goes to show how much thought went into this government plan, because this whole group is brought together by Viola Davis for the purpose of fighting the new metahuman threat posed by people like Superman, who've changed the game in terms of threats to national security. And so she's got to get the most dangerous and most potentially powerful people on Earth to fight these villains. And we got guys like Deadshot who can hit anybody with any gun. And some other guys we're going to talk about who have true superpowers. And he also needs a mentally ill 5'2", 95-pound woman. With no superpowers.
Well, her power she is kind of that she's dangerously sexy. It establishes that pretty early on when she's flirting with a prison guard and trying to draw him into the cell so she can kill him in some way for some reason.
She can fuck him to death.
Yeah. But that didn't work, though. She never uses her sexiness to her advantage in the whole movie.
Well, she uses it to the advantage of the audience.
Hey, guys.
Yeah, exactly. That's it. It's to give all of the dads who are there a chance to be like, oh, now we're talking.
But she also represents, look, I mean, my theory about the movie is divorce. It has nothing to do with politics. It's about divorce. My theory about Harley Quinn is that she represents, like, the perfect woman to a man who has been divorced. She's crazy, she's beautiful, but at the end of the day, just one of the guys.
Absolutely. She hangs out with guys, and as she's described early on in the movie, in a little cameo by Common. So when I saw that, I was like, I know this movie's going to be good.
Hell yeah.
the rapper turned actor Common shows up early.
He has never been in a good movie, by the way. He's like a contraindicator for film quality.
No.
Wait.
He's...
Common was in one of those movies with Steve Harvey where he plays a marriage counselor, and it's called, like, Damn, I Married My Wife. It's a good movie.
No, Common is box office poison, but he describes Harley Quinn as a bad bitch early in the movie, and that's exactly what she is. Her superpowers are being a bad bitch, running in heels, and hitting people with baseball bats. Okay, next on the roster, we have a guy called El Diablo. He's played by Jay Hernandez.
You got nothing to worry about for me. I'm cool, homie.
The only actual potential superhero in the thing. The guy with, like, a genuine superpower. But because...
Yeah, but his whole deal is that...
He won't use it, because otherwise the movie would be over too soon.
Now, this gets into sort of the, I don't know, racism of the movie, yeah. I should say. In that he's the Latino character in the movie.
Oh, he's Latino, is he? I didn't catch that.
His entire face is tattooed to look like a skull. He wears nothing but wife beaters and says things like, I said I would never use the fire again. I said.
Spoiler alert. We find out with 10 minutes left in the movie that he is actually an Aztec fire god. But because of David Ayer's racial science, he knew his entire life that he was an Aztec fire god. But he used this to become, like, a mildly successful drug dealer. Yeah. Not even a good one.
I have to bring this up. It's one of my favorite moments in the movie. When El Diablo gets his own flashback, which is probably one of at least a dozen in this movie, it's revealed that throughout the entire movie, he's just sort of, like, walking around with the Suicide Crew while they're doing action and fighting people, but not doing shit. And that's because he doesn't want to use his fire powers, as Matt explained. And he doesn't want to use his fire powers because he burned his wife and kids to death because they were nagging him too much. And in the flashback, he's explaining to his fellow Suicide Squad, he's like, yo, S.A., when I first started feeling that firepower, my power on the streets increased, and it was like it was feeding one another, Holmes. And then it cuts back to a flashback, and his wife, like, finds his stat. His wife is like, what is this shit? I don't want this in my house. And she, like, slams it down on the kitchen table, and it's like a couple wads of cash, a 38 handgun, and then, like, a few bags of, like, crank or something. And it's just like, yeah, street power.
Yeah, he had exactly $48.
She married a guy with a skull tattooed on his face. Did she think he worked at Barnes & Noble?
Like, his backstory where he just, like, he got too pissed and he lit his wife and kids on fire. That represents how, like, women now are responsible for the breakup of the family more often than men. Like, yeah, you can blame men for it indirectly, yeah, but it's like, fault. Really women.
Pretty clearly, yeah, it's her fault that he burned everybody up, because he's trying to take his kids away, and you can't do that to a man.
You can't. You'll get burnt up.
Diablo was basically a Latino Heisenberg from Breaking Bad.
Yeah, you had to burn that Skylar up, man.
So, upping the racism ante a little bit, let's talk about Killer Croc.
I've got a little theory about Killer Croc. I don't know if you guys notice this, but I think he might be black.
Wait a minute. But you're going to make that kind of reach. You really need to support it, buddy.
His skin color was green. Yeah. If anything,
he was green.
He has scales. Yeah. Okay,
how could he be? He can't be black by definition.
Look.
Oh, sorry.
There were some very subtle clues. Is all I'm saying.
Killer Croc is like the strong man of the squad. He's the muscle, and he's basically a giant crocodile man who has sharp teeth, scales, and lives in the sewer.
And who, as Felix pointed out in his review, was thrown into the Supermax Blacksite prison for the crime of being a crocodile.
Yes.
There's no indication that he ever did anything wrong.
They're like, whoa, buddy, you can't just be a crocodile out there. You are in the cell next to Chelsea Manning.
Look him.
Brady's not entirely wrong, because, I mean, look, he may be black, but one of the clues to that is that late in the movie, like the suicide squatters are trying to, like, you know, negotiate for what they can get out of saving the world. And what Killer Croc wants is BET in his cell. He wants the BET network in
his
cell.
That proves nothing. I love BET.
Maybe he just likes music videos. And at the end of the movie, you actually see him, like, you know, lounging in his sewer cell watching booty shaking on BET.
Killer Croc wasn't black for the first approximately 3 hours of the movie. But in the last 2 hours, the last part of the movie, they were like, okay, yeah, he's black. Because, like, before that, he was just, like, he was a crocodile man. But then, like, in the the most pivotal scene in the movie, my favorite scene in the movie, where they're in a bar, he, like, suddenly is like, I'm beautiful, sister.
He's played by the actor who played Adebisi on Oz, and in this movie is just playing some sort of, like I said, animalistic monster-type character.
A savage beast, if you will.
Yeah, yeah. But it has nothing to do with race. I don't like racial readings of movies. So let's move
on. No, we're not into that.
I'm not into that. Let's move on to the next character, Katana.
Oh, hell yeah. I actually forgot Katana was in the film. I saw this film 12 hours ago, Brady, and I forgot she was in the
Brady, a lot of fans are really disgruntled because there was more Katana in the trailer than made it into the final cut of the movie.
Oh, how many more scenes do you think there were of her talking to her fucking sword?
That was so funny. Okay, so the deal with Katana is she's not a bad person. She is the assistant to the special ops leader, played by Joel Kinnaman, who runs the squad. And she has a samurai sword. And when he introduces her, she just, like, hops onto this helicopter, and she's like, she's got a blade that catches the souls of the people she kills. And you're like, that's kind of badass, but also stupid, but whatever. But you assume that it's just, like, he's saying something to try to make her sound scary. But then later on, they literally show her talking to her sword, and her husband's ghost is in it.
And she's crying.
I'm like, oh, you weren't fucking around with the sword ghost thing. That was real.
She's like, please, ancestors, give me strength to defeat my enemies.
That was the dumbest part about her character, though, I think.
She didn't have anything else.
Right, she had nothing else except for that she dressed like she was in a Nelly Furtado video in 2001. But anyway, so her husband is trapped in the sword. Like, your husband's soul is trapped in the sword. And to, like, honor him, I guess, she has to kill people with the same sword to get their souls trapped in there with her husband.
Company.
Somebody I don't get it. Like, well,
I guess it's somebody for him to talk to. He's bored in there.
It's like a Google Hangout.
Yeah.
I swear to God, at one point, she does say to Colonel Rick Flagg, we mentioned before, he's like the Navy SEAL who's leads the team and controls their bomb collars. But for the purposes of the rest of this podcast, we're just going to refer to him as Chris Kyle.
He's absolutely Chris Kyle.
What I didn't understand was why he needed a... He's introduced as, like, the most badass special forces guy in the military. And he needs a bodyguard for some reason?
Not to mention the fact that everybody in the squad has an explosive pellet in their neck that he could blow up at any moment. He doesn't need the swords, the soul sword lady to protect him.
He's got a team of Navy SEALs, and he's the best Navy SEAL. But at one point in the movie, Katana does say something along the lines of, you want me kill them? Katana's character was like the love interest in Rambo 2. Okay. There's a guy, Slipknot, who's played by a Native American actor, Adam Beach, but he dies so quickly it doesn't even matter. His superpower is climbing buildings.
That's not a power.
No, like, the reason he's able to climb buildings is that he has a grappling hook and a bunch of rope. Then everybody on Earth potentially could have the power, superpower of climbing buildings.
Yeah, that incel kid who just, like, put suction cups on trunk flowers, like he could have been in Suicide Squad.
So good, he's dead.
Slipknot's power was to demonstrate that the bombs in their necks actually worked.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And to remind us all of some amazing new metal from the late 90s and early aughts.
Okay, finally, rounding it out, we get to my favorite Suicide Squatter, Digger Harkness, a.k.a. Captain Motherfucking Boomerang.
Fuck yeah.
I hear we talking about it.
by Australia's own and Matt Brady's cousin, Jay Courtney. Speak on
Breakout
it, Brady.
Breakout star of the film. Like I said, this was called Captain Boomerang and his mates, the Suicide Squad. Captain Boomerang is... How do you sum up his character? He's a criminal. He's slightly racist. And he bloody loves drinking beer. And he's a brony. Did you guys catch that? He's a brony.
Oh, he is a brony, yeah. He has a fetish for pink unicorns.
Yeah, I like that Captain Boomerang doesn't get any complicated backstory or anything. He's just a piece of shit criminal who likes stealing. They say he robbed every bank in Australia.
He has knife boomerangs that he throws.
He throws one and, like, gets it back once.
Once. Yeah.
In the entire film.
Well, as I said to Felix when we left this movie, I said, this movie can be summed up with the statement, when the most likable character in your film is played by Jay Courtney, that is Suicide Squad.
That is extremely Suicide Squad.
Even that said, though, he's barely in the movie.
Brady, I'm not lying to you. I remember I was reading about the release of this movie and all these kind of like pre-publicity interviews that the actors have to give to sell the movie on all these press junkets. And I swear to God, Jay Courtney said, I wanted to play Captain Boomerang as a non-stereotypical Australian.
Fail.
It's just nice. It's good to see positive representations for Australians in film. For too long, we've had to suffer through guys like Chris Hemsworth, who, you know, he's so handsome and he's got abs and he speaks in kind of an Australian accent, but it could be British. And it's about time we just had, like, a racist bogan who's constantly drunk, constantly trying to kill people, mostly women. I think he mostly threatens to kill women throughout the film.
I mean, the plot of the movie is that he has to vandalize 50 kebab carts in an evening.
Through early morning fog I see visions of the things to be, the pains that are withheld for me. I realize and I can see that suicide is painless. It brings on many changes, and I can take or leave it if I please. The game of life is hard to play. I'm gonna lose it anyway. The losing card I'll someday lay. So this is all I have to say. Suicide is...
To explain the actual plot of the movie, unfortunately I feel the need, we have to explain one more character who makes up this this sundry bunch. And that is a witch called Enchantress. She's an ancient spirit that is inhabiting the body of the archaeologist who discovered her, played by Cara Delevingne. Is that how you say her name?
Yes.
Eyebrows, whatever.
Cara Delevingne. Yeah, eyebrows. Enchantress is introduced as the bodyguard to Amanda Waller, who's like the big government, bureaucrat that puts together the Suicide Squad. And she's like an ancient spirit that's one of the most powerful entities on the planet. But Amanda Waller can control her because she has her heart in a suitcase and she's got the archaeologist whose body she inhabits to fall in love with Chris Kyle.
Yeah, this is, I don't know how this plan didn't work. I mean, you think this took all the knowledge. This is actually the most realistic part of the movie, that the deep state is like fucking stupid. Because they're like, we have a being who's basically a god, but we're going to contain it by making it fuck a Green Beret. This can't go wrong. Anyway, it goes wrong like almost immediately.
The spirit of Enchantress gets loose and begins causing havoc in a unnamed American city, or some DC city, like Midway City, I think it's called. The spirit of this ancient god is unleashed and begins, I don't know, causing debris to circle around a train station and turning everyone she encounters into mud people.
Represented miscegenation. This is also a racist movie.
Yeah, we'll get to that in the deep read, but yeah, it's very racially aware. Let's put it that way.
this someone definitely had a racial awakening during this movie. Yeah. But it's not really explained what Enchantress and the other being are doing. It seems like they're just like, they made a hole in the train station and they're like, let's throw the world in the hole.
Yeah, they're gonna destroy Earth through throwing a beam of light into the sky, which is the plot of literally every comic book movie that has been made in the last 20 years.
Yeah.
So yeah, really knocking it out of the park.
The plot of every comic book movie is you have to fill this hole.
Well, that's the genius of Suicide Squad, of assembling a squad of this caliber, is that almost anyone can fill the hole.
You know, there's one character that we haven't discussed yet, and I understand why.
Oh, God,
I forgot. We're too scared to bring him up, because just thinking about him can just make you feel like life isn't worth living, and just send shivers down your spine. And I'm, of course, referring to the arch fiend himself, the most evil man on Earth, Jared Leto. And of course, the punchline of all of this is that he got basically completely cut out of this version of the movie. He's in it for less than 10 minutes. He's very pissed about that, which is pretty hilarious. There's this great quote where he's like, I was just in there and like, you know, they cut me out because I just don't think that they could handle all of the sickness. And there's a version of this that's got me in it, and it's an R rating or it's an X rating. But clearly, that was one of the things. He got totally cut out, and it's clearly because of the recuts, because all the early scenes with him, especially the flashbacks about how Harley Quinn fell in love with him, are just so obviously montaged versions of longer scenes that got just totally destroyed. So he ends up just popping up like every few minutes to do whatever the fuck he's doing, and then he's gone. And you could cut him completely out of the movie and not change the plot at all.
He was mercifully kept to less than 10 minutes in this movie, because honestly, every scene with him, like, Felix, you and I were trying so hard not to.
I couldn't fucking look at Will during any Joker scene, because every scene it would be him, like, walking, he'd be peacocking and wearing a 3-piece suit. Like, he was dressed like a success meme.
No, he's a success meme guy mixed with a PUA, mixed with like a like Macklemore.
He's Michael Porfirio if he fell in a vat of acid.
Yeah, he was.
I think we should hold off on our analysis of the Joker until we get deeper into the family court and divorce reading of this film, because his character really makes no sense and is totally extraneous unless you understand that reading.
Well, just before we finish with the Joker, I just wanted to say, I actually forgot, I made a cake in honor of Will's birthday. It was Will's birthday this week. But in honor of Jared Leto's performance as the Joker, all the candles are actually just used syringes.
Whoa! That's so
fucking twisted.
The real punchline of his character is that Leto's version of the Joker is just a boring drug dealer.
He's like a human version of DeShare's own.
He gets bottle service at the club. He could be any like Armenian gangbanger in LA. Who gives a shit?
And also, he thinks like tattoos. The more tattoos you have, the more badass you are.
Yeah, it's like all. It's everything about it is just try hard bullshit. So it's like, it's one thing to be as pretentious as Jared Leto is, But it is another much more criminal and obnoxious thing to be that pretentious, but at the same time that uncreative and dumb.
I dove pretty deep, you could say.
How deep? Let's just say there was no clowning around. Leto fully immersed himself as the Joker, committing to never breaking character while on set.
When you take on a part like this, you become a detective, a journalist in a way, and I have to say it was the role of a lifetime. It was the most fun I think I've ever had.
And he's so demented and crazy and complicated. Well, there
you learn a lot about me.
Learn a lot about you or the character.
Well, I mean, I guess what I think is fun. But yeah, he's a sick, twisted, but I think very lovable Joker.
So lovable that you'll weirdly find yourself rooting for him, even when he gives you chills.
The laugh. You just nailed the laugh. How did you come up with that?
A lot of experimentation, a lot of really bad laughs. I remember wandering the streets in New York and in Toronto where we were shooting, and I would just laugh out loud and see how people would react to it. When I started to hone in on this laugh, I realized it was the one that really people would turn around and be like, what the hell is that?
If you were so immersed in the character, how are you able to break from that character and actually say goodbye to it after you're done filming?
I think you don't really say goodbye. I think that the Joker's in there somewhere.
So and it is?
I feel like, yeah.
Now I'm scared.
Yeah, you should be. I feel like this film is an introduction to the Joker, and I'm hopeful that we will see more to come.
I think it's safe to say his was the least frightening version of the Joker ever put to film, and that I'm including Cesar Romero's Joker from the Adam West.
Oh, he was way
more. Oh, easily.
That guy put makeup over his own mustache. That's twisted as shit.
My favorite part about this Joker is that he had employees.
Yeah, not like, because like in the other ones, like the Joker gang is a bunch of
they're all
mental
freaks.
Patients.
Yeah.
They're freaks like him.
Yeah.
These guys are just like, hey, boss, we gonna go do some crimes? He's like, yeah, time to do some crimes.
Hey, Joker, I need to fill out another W-2. I just had a kid. We need to change my withholding. I'll get to that. I'm going to talk to payroll.
The way they make them twisted is that when it's time to go and break somebody out of prison or shoot a place up, they have to, like, put on crazy outfits. Like, they have to wear, you know, like a bear suit or a big weird triangular helmet. And you can just know that, like, he makes them do that, and, like, they're getting ready to do it, and they're in the van or something, and they're looking at each other, and they're like, this is really bullshit. I'm not going to be able to see out of this thing. It's like, hey, you know, shut up. You get dental.
You know what it's like? That's like when startups who are just, like, bloodless exploiters of people and capital are like, well, we have a foosball table.
Oh my god, that's totally true. This Joker is like if a Silicon Valley asshole was a drug lord. Like, it's casual Friday, everybody dressed crazy.
Yeah, the whole squad in effect. I mean, there's not much plot to really discuss in this movie. Basically, Enchantress and her god brother take over a city, and they have to send the Suicide Squad into the city to rescue someone who, surprise, surprise, it turns out is just their boss, Amanda Waller, from an office building. And they just, like, they go into the city, and they learn how to work together, and they learn how to work with Navy SEALs, and they fight off an army of mud people. I'm sorry, coal people. Well, this is they did the classic sort of, like, PG-13 movie move where, like, there's a... If everyone are, like, robots or aliens or something, you can kill them with impunity. And in this movie, it's, like, human beings who have been made into these sort of, like, coal monsters who have these kind of burbling black heads. But they're black, so, you know, you get the picture. Okay, this reminds me of one of my favorite moments in the film, when it's a bit of, like, macho dialogue between the Chris Kyle character and Will Smith's Deadshot, where the Chris Kyle character is like, I'm a Navy SEAL. I'm a soldier. That's the most honorable thing in the world. You're a serial killer who takes credit card. Like, if we get in the real shit, you're going to cut and run, just like I know you will. And then, lo and behold, they get in the shit, and Deadshot comes through. He makes crazy dead shots. He shoots all the dead people with shots and saves Chris Kyle. And then they do the wrist, like, pull-up handshake, and Deadshot's like, that's how I cut and run, baby. And it's like, yo, he's just as good as a troop because he showed honor.
Right, which is my favorite. Yeah, we're getting to the core of the movie, which is, like, the entire movie, they're like, these guys are so bad. This is in your dad's superhero movie. These guys are so bad. But, like, 30 minutes into the movie, the main anti-hero is like, I will never leave my duty. I'm even more dedicated than a troop.
So yeah, like, okay, they fight their way through a city of sort of zombies or whatever the fuck you want to call them. Their mission is just to get Amanda Waller out of the city, but that goes all haywire, and then they realize that it's up to them to save the whole world. Like the world that has shunned them and has judged them just because they kill people for fun, money, and hobby. It's the freaks that are going to save the squares, and they have to take it upon themselves to be a team, be a family, and come together. Which brings us to Felix's favorite scene in the movie, when they drink bourbon together at a bar.
They're all sitting around the bar, and Harley Quinn, who every other line she speaks in sort of she talks like James Cagney, I don't know why, is like, society will never accept us, see?
He's like, listen here, fellow suicide squatters, the G-Men are on our tail.
They laugh at me because I'm different. I laugh at them because they're all the same, see? And, Rick Flagg and Deadshot are at the bar. And they're commiserating while Harley Quinn is just, posting things from MySpace. And Rick Flagg says, by the way, warning, if you're at work, if you have just gotten divorced, maybe, if you're about to get divorced, if you have ever been in a relationship with a woman that has gone south, this will make you cry. Rick Flagg, veteran of countless foreign wars, killed numerous men, is stopped by these words when he says, it figures the only woman I ever cared about is trapped inside of a witch.
I can't believe we've got a major Hollywood film that's confirming the long-held theory of Twitter user Strong Piss that women are demons.
Yeah, women are demons.
He had a hand in one of the rewrites, I think.
Yeah, Strong Piss is responsible for this movie.
That scene's a big fuck up. I mean, it's awesome, but it's fucked up in the sense that it happens 10 minutes before the movie ends, and then it's the entire basis for them coming together and being like, we're family, when they take on the monsters, when they barely talk to each other before that point, which just goes into how horribly paced and jumbled everything is. They spend an hour doing these chopped up montages that are clearly Cuisinarted versions of the first movie to set these characters up, and then they have them go off and fight without ever really having them meet each other. And so then they're in the bar and all bourboning it up, and you're like, these people have not had any kind of relationship, and now they're friends. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, you say that, but okay, they went through a stressful situation together. They killed a lot of people, and then they are, if you commiserate, if you bond over the Bastard's Brew bourbon, I mean, I think that's all it takes if you're alpha enough.
I guess I wouldn't know.
I'm pretty sure. I'm a beta. I'm pretty sure Killer Croc was actually drinking a 40.
So they come together as a family for the boss fight of the movie, which was sort of a video game cutscene.
Oh, God, so terrible. Okay, this is literally true. I'm watching the movie with my friend, and when they cut to Enchantress, and for some reason they've decided to shoot her full on with full lighting in this CGI bikini, moving around like she's working an invisible hula hoop, and yeah, flames so are good. Going off it's behind so her good. And it's I just so said out loud, I didn't yell at the screen, I just said out loud, matter of factly, awful. It was just, my body rejected it. It was like, nope. That's not a movie.
And to me, the most offensive and disgusting part of this movie is when Enchantress, in order to throw the squad off their game, projects a vision into each of the members of the squad's head of what their perfect fantasy is. She's like, no, retreat into fantasy. Don't be here. Don't fight me. And worst of all, Harley Quinn, in her deepest, darkest, yep, most twisted heart of hearts... Her perfect fantasy is being a nice, normal housewife and mother of two married to a non-twisted version of Jared Leto.
Yep. She's not actually sick. She just wants to change him because she thinks she can.
She got a bunch of tattoos and took an acid bath because she thought she could change a bad boy.
Typical dizzy broads. Am I right, guys? The one thing I was really bummed out about, though, is that during that scene, Killer Croc is underwater trying to plant a bomb, for some stupid reason. And so they didn't get to show him his vision of perfection, which I'm fairly positive would have been Rex and Effects Rump Shaker video.
it would have been like he goes to the White House and he gets a medal for winning the knockout game. I like that. So I think that the Harley Quinn thing, it's sort of a Dutatian I'm on the pill type thing. We're like, really what women biologically desire is to be normies who pump out children. But society makes them insane.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, like, okay, so to fight the big boss, El Diablo unleashes his final form, which is an Aztec fire god that he'd been keeping under wraps all this time when he was making $40 a day selling speed on the streets of L.A.
Yeah, he's like,
making deals with the Sons of Anarchy.
Yeah, he was exactly the type of guy who would make deals with Sons of Anarchy. Yeah. Because he walked away from every single drug deal with about $62, lived in a shitty house, and had a shoebox filled with dilapidated guns.
Which he totally needed because he could shoot fire out of his hands.
Yeah. He's like, yeah, yeah. That was the only thing that can give you an edge at extremely unsuccessful drug dealing.
So they defeat the monster, they save the world, and as Felix said, they learn that the darkest, most twisted thing you can do as a villain is the right thing.
Yeah, that is the thesis of the movie, that like, in this day and age, the most twisted thing you can do is obey the rules.
And obey authority.
Yeah.
But the movie also shows that, like, the Viola Davis character, Amanda Waller, is actually the most twisted of them all. The square is the real freak, is the message of this movie.
Yeah, but she's like a bad person, but she's bad on behalf of America, so it's okay. It's like any of David Ayer's bad cops who he fucking worships.
Now,
it's now, like, yeah, they bend the rules and they kill people, but they get a job done.
At no point in this movie is any of the Suicide Squad shown doing anything truly evil or upsetting that you would be like, oh, well, that's an unlikable character, except for Amanda Waller, who shoots a bunch of IT guys who are working for her because they didn't have clearance to look upon the, I don't know, ancient enchantress or something like that.
Which raises the question, why the fuck were they in a secure bunker command center in the first place if they didn't have clearance?
That was just Geek Squad.
That scene exists so that you'd be like, whoa. Maybe, yeah, maybe the most twisted people are the ones you'd least expect.
The ones who wear suits and don't have tattoos. Okay, let's get down into let's drill down the meta reading of the movie that Felix outlined in his Deadspin article. I hope you haven't spoiled it yet so far, even though I told you to read it. But, Felix, lay out for us the divorce court reading of Suicide Squad.
All right, so the moral center of the movie is a disgusted father. That much is clear. That's a very obvious reading. Deadshot has all the power in the world, but family court can reduce us all to just mere mortals, no matter what kind of power we have. The greatest king to the smallest pauper, they're all an ant in the eyes of an all-powerful family court judge.
Of Judge Ellen Tao.
Judge Ellen Tao, represented by Amanda Waller, who represents the government and women judges who just don't understand. But, this is where the Joker comes in. When we see the Joker, we're like, oh, he's just like a weird, normal guy. But no, he's not. The Joker represents what happens if, you know, you remember what the best Joker, Heath Ledger, said. He said, whatever doesn't kill you makes you a stranger. And the people thought that was amazing and still do. And it is. But the same thing holds for this Joker. But what didn't kill him and made him stranger was the process of divorce. It made him a pickup artist. He wears a white blazer. He wears jewelry. He gets cool tattoos. He changes his hair. He goes to clubs. He gets bottle service. He even changes his name to Joker, which sounds like a pickup artist name.
Yes. I described Jared Leto's Joker as the divorced dad who reads Neil Strauss's The Game, decides to dye his hair and get a statement blazer and start hitting up the clubs.
That's exactly him. And Harley Quinn represents the idealized woman after divorce.
hot, crazy, and one of the guys, as we already explained.
Absolutely. And the process in which Joker like dunks her in the chemical vat and electrocutes her, that's what happens when an experienced man hooks up with a younger woman.
The game.
That's the game. It's Kinoing.
The Joker does negging and Kino a lot in this movie.
Tons of it. He can't stop doing it.
Leave her worthless, silly job as a fucking psychologist.
You have to be crazy with him.
You know, but that's really fitting, and we talked about this earlier, and it really made me realize how true Felix's vision for this film is, because, as we all know, the men's rights movement was one of the germinators of the broader alt-right. Right? Like, there's, like, you want to, like, definitely. Create the Venn diagram of people who contributed to the original red pill lifestyle. Was a strong current of that was father's rights, men's rights guys. And then that worldview ended up leading to other views that ended up culminating in the thing that we like to call the alt-right, otherwise known as anime Nazis. And the truth of that is found in the fact that there's also a reading of Suicide Squad in which it's more explicitly an alt-right film. And we realized that when we were talking about it when I was in the town a few days ago. Amanda Waller in this interpretation is basically the government. I believe we said Valerie Jarrett was the closest comparison.
Yeah.
Figure from the globalist state who, in bringing Enchantress over, who, by the way, was found in a cave, I believe in the Middle East, I'm not sure.
No, I think it was South America. It was South America.
Well, one of the duskier climes.
She's an amnesty thug.
Yeah, exactly. So she brings Enchantress over, like a Syrian refugee or amnestied illegal alien. And what does she do? She takes over a city and immediately starts creating an army of mud people to do her bidding.
Hell yeah.
And then it is up to a squad composed of a disgusted dad and a crazy woman who also in her heart knows that she wants to be a mother, and Chris Kyle, who come together to stop the menace from destroying white America.
They are assisted by a couple crude racial stereotypes, but I mean,
right, but that's like, you know, they're like the black friend who sort of ratifies everything because they agree with you about black people.
They're the good ones.
Yeah, exactly. Like, Killer Croc knows that they need to pull up their pants.
Yeah, no, they're like when Milo Yabba Dabba Duopolis is like, oh, I'm gay and I'm Jewish.
And, like, you know, to Felix's divorce court interpretation, at the end of the movie, the villains, they save the world, but all they get is a measly few years knocked off their life sentence in Supermax prison. So, like, an ungrateful world just sentences them back to prison again with a few minor perks, and Will Smith does get to see his daughter like one time or every
it's like
other
they
day.
Got their it's like they got their wage garnishment slightly reduced for their child support.
But Felix, as you told me, it's like, you know, a dad can never win in family court no matter what he does.
Right,
even,
no matter,
even like, if he saves the world, even if he's like Judge Ellen Tao, I now present this evidence, me saving the world from an ancient evil goddess.
Exactly, like people want like a nice glitzy Hollywood ending, but those don't exist in the world of family court. Dads will go through hell and back for their daughters, get them back from their worthless mothers. But like, even if you show the government, like, I passed my urine test, I didn't go outside the bounds of my ankle monitor, I haven't gotten a DUI in the last 6 months, they'll still be like supervised custody. That's what that represented.
So the movie closes with Will Smith's supervised visit to his daughter, basically. Brady, what's your reading of this film?
Well, mine doesn't go quite as deep as your guys. It's not as thoroughly thought through. But mine is that the Suicide Squad is basically an internet message board or even Twitter. Amanda Waller is the humorless mod who just wants to ban everyone for having fun.
And being racist.
Yeah, and Deadshot's Peter Dow. He used to be a ruthless killer who's killed thousands, but now he's just all about his hashtag daughter, who he loves. Harley Quinn obviously is a queen, a yes queen slay, and the Joker is a fuckboy sliding into DMs to tell her to go to bed. And that's about all I've got. Oh, Captain Boomerang is an Australian shit poster, obviously, and the other two guys aren't really characters, so they don't really have Twitter matchups.
Well, it makes sense, though, and then that would, like, give it, that would, that's the other sort of part of the Venn diagram that made up the alt-right would, you know, Gamergate. And so, like, so it makes sense. You've got, like, a pure alt-right reading, and then subsidiary readings for the forces that created the outright men's rights and Gamergate. Because, yeah, then, like, you could also imagine, in my mind, then Harley Quinn would be like that Gamergate porn star. I don't know if you guys know who that is. There's this one porn star who's like, those guys just want ethics and games journalism. Am I right, girls? And I'm a woman, and they all agree with me, and then they all worship her. Or, like, maybe Christina Hoff Sommers. I don't know. One or the other.
Based Quinn.
Yeah.
Are we ready for Suicide Squad 2? Do we have any speculation on what will be included in that film?
Hopefully, more racism.
Get a Taylor Tequila cameo.
I hope they go to Australia, and they like to have to fight, like, giant wombats or something. and then Captain Boomerang can sort of take the lead, and he'd be like, "You're in my world now, mates."
Yeah, I want a lot more Captain Boomerang.
I'm just hoping that there isn't any more Joker, because I don't know if I can handle it. My doctor said that I got the maximum amount I could be exposed to before I get terminally twisted.
You know, when our Suicide Squad assembled for the first time to discuss Batman vs. Superman, I know we closed it out with our Turkish politics reading of that movie. We don't have one for this movie because the essential production process and how stitched together it was from so many different competing cuts of the movie essentially makes it impossible to read any sort of uniform vision like we could with Zack Snyder's Batman versus Superman, which, despite being a mess, is definitely a Zack Snyder movie. It's much harder to say with this film, but I think we can safely say Suicide Squad is 100% American-made and reflects everything about the culture and values of America in 2016.
Yes.
Absolutely.
If people want to understand what 2016 was about, just watch Suicide Squad. It's all in there.
Put it in the time capsule now and open it 50 years from now in dark and twisted America.
Yeah, and people are going to be like, "Oh, that's not dark and twisted. That's like, what was that rated? G?"
Felix, one of your Deadspin commenters wanted to knock the smug smirk off your face for talking shit about dads.
That was awesome. That guy, like, threatened to beat up, like, four people. Would you like to respond to your critics?
Yes, I would. Sir. First of all, sir. Resorting to threats of physical violence because of my father's rights advocacy, first of all, proves my point. That's a no true Scotsman right there. You're already starting off in a deficit. I hope that you can fight better than you can argue, sir. Second of all, I'm not being smug. I'm a father adjacent ally. I'm not a father myself, but I'm father adjacent. Third of all, get out of my mentions.
All right, guys, I think we put this one to bed. Till next time.
Yeah.
Yep. I'm spent.
Thanks to Matt Brady for joining us.
Thanks
to the Suicide Squad for saving the world.
You guys are my Suicide Squad.
You're my Captain Boomerang.
Keep your boomerang ready.
Bye, guys.
Peace.
Laugh, everyone, at the clown. He's the best one in town.
And I've read stories online, people saying that you really got, like, you were, is this true or is this urban legend? Mailing rats, mailing bullets. You were just, like, insane. I mean, you really embraced the Joker.
Yeah, I did embrace the Joker, and I had a lot of fun with it. And, you know, he's a fun guy. He likes to play games. He likes to give gifts. He did give some nice gifts. I did give some cupcakes. Nobody likes to talk about that. I wouldn't have eaten them, but I did give some cupcakes. But he's a very colorful character. And each day you never know what you're going to get. It could just be like a crayon out of the box. You know, a different shade.
I hear you.